WTF is Retail, presented by Excellent Zephyr.
So welcome back to WTF is Retail. We are joined by Laura Riches, the co-founder of Laylo.
Hi.
Thanks for coming on. How are you doing today?
Really good, thank you. Nice to be here.
Awesome. So I am going to say, normally we do kind of traditional retail brands, but I'm excited because we finally got wine on the podcast, something we can all relate to. But what I'm really interested in, I'm sure people listening are interested about, is wine is kind of like a traditional kind of market, I imagine. Obviously loads of heritage. You guys are doing something a bit different, trying to reinvent wine, as say, you know, and I'm excited to hear what you have to say.
Yeah.
Awesome. So I guess my first question is, which we always start with, is, you know, how and why Box Wine? How did this come about?
Cool. So the how is quite a funny story. So my background prior to starting Laylo was at Naked Wines. Mm-hmm. So I was the marketing director there and had a really good friend who was the COO, another Laura R, which is very confusing. And we both loved what we called a Tuesday night wine, which is a lovely glass of wine, not because it's your birthday, not because, you know, you got a promotion, but just because having a glass of wine is nice. And we were in a really lucky position to do that because often in the office there would be half open bottles, you know, we'd be tasting and things, so we could just nab something, take it home with us. And you didn't have that sort of, you know, ticking time bomb of this wine's going to go, you know, sour, it's going to taste like vinegar. So left Naked Wines, was, you know, freelancing in the pandemic and thought, oh, do you know what, like, if I'm going to start something, it's probably now that, you know, this would be a good time for me. But like you say, the wine industry can be quite archaic, and I really wanted to be where the action was happening. So started to look at, you know, packaging, which is, you know, clearly where there's lots of innovation in wine. You see cans, you see pouches. I'm like, wait one second. Boxed wine stays fresh for 6 weeks once you've opened it. So you can have a Tuesday night wine. You can have a glass of wine and it will still be super fresh weeks later. So I had this idea of starting a boxed wine brand. I started to write a presentation. I have no idea who it was going to be presented to. And then was sitting at my kitchen table, August 2020, and I got a text from my good friend Laura saying, I've had this idea, I really want to run it past you. It's a, you know, new company idea. I'm like, what is it? And she said, it's boxed wine. I think it's the future. Ooh. And I had to sort of screenshot everything I've been doing and say, you know, I've had the same idea. Like, either everyone's had this idea or it's just the two of us. And we know we work together really well. We're really good friends. Let's go for it. And that's what we did.
Amazing.
That is a coincidence. And you're both called Laura. Mm. Both with an R.
Yeah.
And you're both like boxed wine.
Exactly.
I mean,
we're actually quite different people.
Yeah. Are you though? It
does sound like we're basically the same person. But that's what's cool about having a co-founder, right? Is, you know, I look after all the kind of brand and marketing side of things, and Laura's like an ops whiz. Mm-hmm. So actually, she's the kind of yin to my yang, maybe. Like, you know, we have different skills, and that's why, you know, I think this business even happened in the first place, because we both bring such different things to the table, despite sounding like the same person.
Yeah. So I guess the question you get a lot is, boxed wine is usually, or in the past was associated as quite cheap wine. I know, and I will admit, when I was a youth, I would drink boxed wine in the park. And
18 years old, obviously.
Yes, fully legal of age. And, you know, that's what I used to do. How, you know, was it a big branding challenge to kind of change that perception? Did you need to educate people about, you know, what boxed wine is and the benefits of it and stuff like that?
So I wouldn't like to age you, but it's likely that when you were 18 or plus drinking this wine, so they used to line the boxes. So if you've got a box of wine, inside you've got a bag, essentially. Mm-hmm. It's bag in box is the sort of technical name for the format. And that bag used to be lined with aluminium. And the reason that you do that is because wine, the enemy of wine in a sort of, in this context, is oxygen. So you want to make sure that no oxygen is reaching the wine inside, mm-hmm. so that it will stay delicious for, you know, however long it's sitting on the shelf. So with aluminium, it used to kind of crack, and it meant that the wine would oxidize very quickly. So you would only put like cheap wine into a box, because you just didn't want to risk, it, you know, your good wine turned into vinegar. That all changed about 5 years ago, possibly slightly longer now. So there's a new material, I won't get too geeky about it, there's this new material that basically does the same job, but it's completely malleable. So it's now possible to put amazing wine into a box. You're confident it's not going to oxidise. So like you say, now it's really about kind of educating people and helping them to realise that actually boxed wine for everyday drinking wine doesn't have to mean cheap plonk. It can be something really delicious that you can be proud to serve.
I actually never knew that. I mean, the wine I had tasted like vinegar on the first glass. So it must have been oxidizing for a long time.
Yeah, I guess the good thing, though, that you guys have done is changed. Well, you've got this new material, but also the branding on the outside, which we may get to later in the podcast, but it now looks way classier. Mm. Like, we've got, for the watchers, a box in front of us. And you can see this is not just a plain box, right?
Yeah.
So I guess you can use that to your advantage, shall we say, in the branding process, and that's your background.
100%. So, I mean, if you go into a supermarket today, which is probably where you're most likely to go and pick up a boxed wine, and you look at the shelf, often it would be, you know, a kind of sun setting over a vineyard stock photo or something. It sort of doesn't communicate quality. And actually with Lalo, what we wanted to do was say, do you know what? This isn't the same as boxed wines that people have tried before. So why should we make it conform to kind of like tropes of the normal packaging? So instead we use all five visible faces that we've got to kind of tell the story of the wine, the winemaker. They're all completely different. And for it to be like a conversation starter, not just a kind of poor excuse for a bottle.
Okay, and to use it as a conversation starter, what is the thinking behind this box then?
Okay, cool. So this is a Grüner Veltliner, which is an Austrian wine, an Austrian white wine. This wine is actually from the Esterhazy family vineyard. So the Esterhazy family are like royalty in Austria. And these guys have these kind of very traditional vineyards. And this is a kind of oil painting from kind of traditional Austria. In fact, it even features the Esterhazy family palace.
Wow.
What's quite cool about this wine, actually, is that the guy who makes it, a guy called Rob, he's from South Africa. And he's a kind of like, he's super cool. Like, he, you know, loves rock music. He is quite sort of eccentric. He brings with him a whole load of like new winemaking techniques and styles, and he, you know, he's a bit sort of rebellious, if you like. So if you buy this wine from our website, you also get a load of stickers, which are all kind of like South African flags and animals and balloons and things, you know, fancy dress for the people on the design, to kind of try and communicate. I mentioned, you know, it's about storytelling, to try and communicate the idea of this very traditional winery where this kind of rebel winemaker came and did something a bit different.
Super cool, super cool. And you touch on there, like, obviously coming from all corners of the world, potentially, the different wines. How does your process work in terms of tasting and choosing some that you want to put to market, basically, as Lalo, you know?
Yeah, so we're super fussy. I can imagine
you know your wines.
Well, kind of, but also, well, yes, but like, if you walk into a supermarket, I don't know if you guys find this, you walk down the aisle and you're just bombarded with bottles, right? You've got label, 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 and it's overwhelming. Like, even if you do know about wine, it's a lot. So we were very kind of clear from the get-go that we didn't want people to feel that way when they come to our website or when they, you know, buy us from a retailer or wherever. So we decided we'd never have more than 10 wines on the website.
Okay.
But the wines we do have would be things that we felt really confident, like, would be crowd pleasers. So, I mean, our best-selling wine is our Sauvignon Blanc, and, you know, we've introduced it. Tempranillo, so Rioja's the UK's favourite red wine. So we're quite intentional there. And then, I guess, you know, if we're looking for a wine, so if we've got a shopping list, we get lots of samples, we meet lots of people, we go to lots of tastings. But ultimately, it's the wine that, you know, we pour in our glass and we think, oh yeah, that really made me smile.
On a Tuesday night.
Yeah, exactly. It's a Tuesday night wine, you know. And I think Laura and I have quite a good sort of instinct now for what that tastes like. And, you know, I can catch her eye and I can tell that she loves wine. Mm-hmm. And that's really important to us, you know. It's got to be something you love.
I will say, like, when I was on your website, coming from Spain, or living in Spain, I'm not coming from Spain, Verdejo. I'll say Verdejo. And I was in a really posh restaurant for a work thing.
Were you?
I was, yeah. I don't go there very often, but I was this one occasion in a posh restaurant.
Okay.
Thanks, Ian. And I said to the guy, Ian said to me, pick a wine, and obviously I know nothing about wine. And I said, do you have Verdejo? Because I thought that was quite cultured of me. And he started freaking out, and he was flicking through this book of about 500 wines, and he didn't have one. And, you know, it's not common, I imagine, it seemed like it wasn't a common wine in the UK, right?
Mm.
So, I mean, is that, first of all, is that true that Verdejo is not common in the UK, and why did you choose that wine?
Yeah, so I'd say it was becoming more popular, but most people freak out because they're not sure how to say it, and then they're also...
Did you say it right?
Yeah, you okay. did, I say that's pretty good.
That would be really awkward.
Awkward, should let you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's becoming more popular. Part of the reason why Verdejo was, you know, common, or you could frequently find it in Spain, is because it's, I guess it's like the domestic white wine, right? So if you walk into a tapas bar, it's pretty good with food. So, you know, if you're in a restaurant in Spain, it's likely that if you ask for a white wine, they would default to Verdejo because it's a local grape and it's really delicious. It's kind of like Sauvignon Blanc in the UK. Like, if you ask for a white wine, it's probably Sauvignon Blanc.
Yeah.
So I guess, like, in the UK, we've kind of, like, caught our attention, and you know, there are more and more Verdejos making it out of Spain, and sommeliers and people love to have something that's a bit different, right? But you're right, it's not that commonplace. I mean, the reason we chose it was actually because Ruth and Anna, who made our Verdejo, made our first ever wine. They made our Tempranillo, and they're amazing kind of champions of, like, indigenous grapes.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that we found Lelo customers love is something that's, like, a bit off the beaten track, that's a bit different. And, you know, frankly, if you're getting something that doesn't have, like, a designer label wine name, you probably get a lot better value.
Mm,
so
yeah.
Our Verdejo really, you know, punches above its weight in terms of style, quality, because it's not got that immediate kind of brand recognition.
Yeah, and I suppose from a marketing perspective, you know, it comes with that Spanish kind of feel, right? And I saw on your website the imagery.
Mm.
It was really on point, really cool. You got, I'm presuming, all the, you know, the sardines and the things you got on there for that picture.
Mm.
Did you, like, import them in, or where did you get that stuff from? Because it's really, like, on point. Like, I've seen the stuff in that picture in the supermarket down the road from
there. Yeah. So, I mean, good question. So, I went to... on the Portobello Road, there's a Spanish supermarket. It's called, like, Garcia and Son or something. It's really kind of old school, and it's got all the kind of Ortiz products and the Pirello olives and things. But so yeah, we didn't import it, but I happened to know of this kind of, like, little gem at the supermarket. Yeah,
cool. Yeah, I guess speaking about Spain, which is super relevant to us, you obviously have wines from different parts of the world, not just the UK. And you started your business in 2020, is that right?
Mm.
So I'm going to go there. Brexit, how does that affect your business as it sort of really was starting out, and your processes in terms of shipping the wines in, sending them back out to your customers? Did it have any effect?
Yeah, so when Nora and I discovered that we'd had the same idea, we kind of thought, well, wine's quite seasonal. People buy a lot of wine in November and December, January not so much. So we knew that we had this kind of, like, burning bridge, like a timeline that we needed to work to, so that we could create this, you know, first, I'm going to call it an MVP. We never said anything quite so fancy.
That's what it is now.
just, you know, with hindsight, our MVP.
Mm-hmm.
So we set to work. We knew Ruth and Anna from Naked Wines days. We knew we could trust them. They had this great Tempranillo Rioja, perfect for Christmas. So we went through the process of bringing that wine to the UK, boxed it, bagged it, filled it, sold it.
Mm-hmm.
January the following year was when Brexit happened.
Yeah.
And to be honest, we hadn't really been thinking about it that much because, you know, everything that came before was just exploratory. It was side hustle. We were both still working. So I guess we experienced very briefly how easy it was to bring wine to the UK, you know, talking like, you know, sort of sailed through customs.
Yeah.
We then had this like really quite challenging period for a few months after Brexit happened, where the paperwork was new, the processes were new. We had our Sauvignon Blanc, our second wine, you know, on its way, whole periods where we just didn't know where it was. And the whole thing was just quite chaotic. I mean, I think now the partners we use, we understand a lot more about the process. Mm-hmm. Everyone else does, you know, we were kind of all in it together.
Yeah.
And it's a lot smoother now than it was, but it was, you know, if you think about the sort of perfect storm of things that are difficult when starting a business, like if you import product and everything around importing product changing overnight,
that was
pretty big for us.
Yeah, since a lot of people said that, but I just thought that question for you guys was must have been a killer,
particularly for, you know, wine, which I imagine there's specific you know, rules on anyway, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, one of the things that makes it quite hard to start a company in, I'm going to say alcohol more broadly, is that there's, you know, understandably a lot of rules and regulation around, you know, your marketing, for example, or, you know, where you can store the product and the licenses you need. So something that we discovered was it went from like a side hustle to fully fledged company kind of faster than I think if we were fashion or homewares, because we kind of had to have that, you know, official, you know, infrastructure around it. Like, we had to have the right licenses. We couldn't sell product unless we had a premises license and, you know, all of that good stuff. So it was a real pain at the time, but actually I think it probably ultimately sped up the growth of our company because we just had to be very official very quickly.
Something I'm really interested in here is, like, how's it work in terms of, like, does the wine come in bulk and then you kind of pack it yourselves in the UK into boxes, or how's that done, like the whole packaging and putting it all together, the product?
Yeah, so firstly, worth mentioning, it's not our reason for being, but boxed wine happens to be a lot more carbon efficient than glass bottles. Mm. So it's, you know, 90% less carbon is generated than glass bottles. And the big driver of that is transportation.
Mm-hmm.
So if you imagine, glass bottles were created like 200 years ago, and they haven't, you know, they've got variations in shape and things, but they haven't really changed over that period. But what has changed is where we get our wines from. So, you know, it's not unusual for us to order a New Zealand Kiwi Sauvignon. Yeah, obviously, Kiwi, New Zealand. A Kiwi Sauvignon Blanc.
And you pointed at me there.
And that's come, you know, a huge distance all the way around the world. And with glass bottles, they're, you know, probably weigh as much as the wine inside, and they're very awkwardly shaped. So that was, like I said, not the reason for being, but is a great benefit of our product. And so in our supply chain, we try and kind of live by those principles of making sure that we can confidently say that we are reducing the carbon impact of the wine that, that people are drinking. So how does that impact us? Well, it means that we, at the moment, only source from Europe, because you can get amazing wines from Europe. You don't need to go to the New World to get incredible, you know, great everyday drinking wines. It does mean we're then really, like, aware of the carbon footprint of the supply chain. So we do bring it over usually in bulk. The reason I say, like, usually is sometimes you've got, you know, a wine that's perhaps not so suited to transit over distances, and it's better to pack it at source. But I guess the primary thing is, how do we bring this wine safely, and how do we make sure it tastes amazing? But a very close second is, how can we make sure that we're then also standing by our kind of green credentials?
Yeah, and you said that you've already touched on it. You have a lot of, you know, high level previous marketing experience. How has this helped kind of mold your marketing brand and strategies with Lalo? You know, your previous experiences, did you, you know, learn a few tricks of the trade, and, or, you know, what have you done there?
Yeah, I mean, I think I maybe thought there would be more in common than there is between, you know, at the point when I was at Naked Wines, we had hundreds of thousands of customers and a team who had kind of already done the hard bit, like establishing like the tone of voice and, you know, who knew kind of what worked. There are things that are consistent. Like I think that what Naked Wines managed to do brilliantly was be a challenger brand, even when it was pretty large, you know, to have, you know, to be brave about the tone of voice, to realise that you don't necessarily need to, like, not everyone needs to love you. And actually, I think that's something we brought with us at Lalo. But then I'd say there's more that we have kind of learnt from scratch or learnt through testing, learning, discarding what doesn't work and then iterating than I perhaps thought up front.
Yeah.
Interesting. And you also have, to jump back to the products and sort of your operations, he asking the marketing questions because that's his background, but in terms of operations, you have a B2B offering, right? You sell to stockists or to other e-com stores. Make sure I'm correct there. But
so it's actually both. So the main thing we do is B2C.
Yeah, okay.
Through the website, and that's a standard e-com model. So you can come to our website, buy a box. We don't tie you into a subscription or anything. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, come and buy the wine. We're pretty confident you're going to love it and come back. We found over the last year that more and more kind of restaurants and bars, and also, you know, retailers are keen to explore alternative formats for wine, mainly because of what I said around sustainability. So, you know, we're all trying to do make the little swaps where we can. And in this instance, not only do you not compromise on wine quality, but you also arguably have a better experience because it stays fresher longer. So we're now selling into bars and restaurants, and we also sell into what we call the off-trade. So you've got on-trade, on-premise, and then off-trade is shops. And that's, you know, the likes of Planet Organic and lovely delis and things where you might go to buy a lovely bottle of wine. So it's a bit combination of the two.
Yeah, cool. I imagine they're slightly different ways, but it all builds into creating this brand and getting you guys seen in different places, right? So it leads me next to the next question a little bit of, you know, you're talking about now you're sort of inching into sort of some bricks and mortar stores that might have you. Do you think there's ever in the roadmap a possibility of us seeing Lalo on the high street? Or do you think it's just not really in the roadmap at all?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, obviously, I think one of the things that we've learned over the last couple of years is that, you know, everything's constantly changing and you can have a really great plan, but things will happen and it will change the course. And, you know, so I've learned kind of not to say never. I think had we gone into, you know, even bars, restaurants or supermarkets or whatever sooner, then that would have been quite tricky to establish a brand, because so much of what we're doing is having a conversation and trying to challenge preconceptions. And there's only so much, even with, like, you know, design that looks completely different and, you know, imagery, there's only so much that you can communicate on that shelf edge. But I think, you know, actually over the last couple of years, I mean, the boxed wine market has over doubled in the last couple of years. There seems to be a lot more kind of understanding of the benefits. I mean, we were page three of the Times before Christmas. The idea that we would be in the kind of main paper, you know, when we first started was just, you know, I couldn't even imagine that. So I think in the kind of psyche, people understand more about boxed wine now, and, you know, we've built a, you know, cult following of people who love us, and whether that's customers or critics or whatever. So it feels like the right time to be asking those questions.
Right, for sure. And I guess one other thing that you just mentioned is, I think I saw on your LinkedIn, you're talking about PR and, you know, like getting in the Times, for example, sounds like a massive achievement. Is that a big part of your marketing strategy? You know, being seen in these big publications or being talked about all the time, I imagine, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think there's two things. Firstly, like, I'm a big believer in having a kind of full marketing funnel. I just don't think it's the smartest choice to only focus on performance marketing, mm-hmm. even though it can feel really good, you know, like I put this money in and I get these customers out. Ultimately, you're asking a lot of your performance marketing if it's like the only interaction someone has with your brand. Like, you know, we all know all those sort of stats. I've no idea how they calculate it, but you know, you have to see a brand 7 times before you actually then, yeah. you know, recognize it and might convert. So I think for that reason, brand marketing, mm-hmm. so, you know, sort of slightly broader than PR is super important and is something that we knew we needed to do from the get-go.
Yeah.
I think specifically with PR, it's something I really enjoy. Mm-hmm. It's like probably my favourite part of my yeah. job. And, you know, in this category, so if you think about in fashion, how many like influencers or writers there are who write about fashion, is, you know, there's almost, you know, for every subcategory in fashion, there's, you know, many yeah. people who will influence customers and will set the trends. In wine, very few people are those kind of trendsetters. So you've got these amazing critics. You've got, you know, there are people like Jancis Robinson or, you know, Matthew Dukes or whoever who are, they are the like trendsetters. And it, and yes, there's sort of noise around that, but the direction of the industry sits in the hands of a fewer people. So again, I think for that reason, PR is something that's ultra important in this category.
Yeah. And these big players that you're talking about, I can't remember the names because, again, I'm not a wine expert, but the, you know, how hard is it to get them to rave about your wine? You know, what would need to be done? Would they do it over a box wine, or are they stuck in the old ways of traditional wine, you know?
No, so I mean, I'm not saying it's easy to get coverage on boxed wine. It's certainly mm-hmm.
yeah.
not the case. But one thing that is very cool about, you know, the sort of like thought leaders in wine is that, you know, often they are quite open minded and you know are trying to kind of make a conscious change, particularly when it comes to sustainability. Actually, yeah. and I'd say that really is a hot topic in the industry. So. Mm-hmm. It's not that it's easy, but I think it's not inconceivable for a boxed wine to be shown alongside, you know, a bottled equivalent, and for that to be proudly something that the critics would recommend. And I mean, we know this because we are featured
and they've done it
a lot,
yeah.
and they've really supported us. But I guess I think that it's just making sure that we are getting consistent coverage. You know, with these things, you they're not quite evergreen, you know. Mm. You can use the reviews, you can pop it on your website and to can use that PR to your advantage, but ultimately the best thing is for it to be, you know, continuously spoken about and always in the kind of public consciousness. So it's kind of ongoing, but yeah, they're good eggs and they are really behind the brand.
It's almost means. Like you need to go on lots and lots of podcasts to keep speaking about.
Exactly, it's almost like I would like to tell everyone about the brilliant thing that is boxed wine.
Yeah,
and that leads us quite nicely into: do you have any exciting plans for the future? You know, any hot tips you want to give us about Lalo? You know, what are the plans, short term and long term?
Yeah, so I mean, like I said, we're now looking at bars and restaurants and mm-hmm. you know, expanding distribution. So. Obviously can't give away too many secrets, but there are some really big conversations happening there, and that's exciting because the idea that someone could, you know, nip down the road and pick up a box of Lalo so cool. is really cool. And you know, we've already to an extent seen the power of that. You know, we're on Zap, the ultra fast grocery app, and you know, in all the Planet Organic stores, and it's just been, you know, really game changing and exciting. Otherwise, I mean, we're constantly on the lookout for really exciting new wines. And, you know, our customers love a new wine. And some of those are things you'd have heard of, but others are from kind of off the beaten track regions. And that's what keeps it fresh, right? Yeah. Keeps it exciting.
Super cool. Yeah. So I guess that comes to my final part of the show. What we like to do is sort of ask you a little game, basically. What is your favorite retail brand to shop at? It can't be Lalo. And why, basically?
Yeah, so I was thinking about this because I knew this was coming.
Because you heard the
podcast.
Yeah,
because I do my research.
Oh,
you know?
My God.
No
change the question now.
No surprises here. I mean, so I think that my favorite brand, it's quite old school answer, is The White Company. Okay. And the reason why I love The Bike Company is because it has been relevant to me at like every stage of my adult life. You know, from buying like a lovely candle to, you know, when I was in my 20s to feel, you know, in my rented apartment to make it feel like a bit luxe, through to when I had my daughter and, you know, as a treat, you put her in these beautiful Bike Company things, or, you know, now I've a bit of a sort of West London mummy picking up my like clothes from the Bike Company in sort of identical vein. So I just really love their clarity. I love the experience. I love that when you walk into the store, it just feels, you know, consistently high quality. And I think it's just a very cool brand.
Awesome. Well, first of all, thank you so much for coming on. That was really insightful.
Pleasure.
For wine lovers, but people who don't know stuff about wine, that changes everything, and we'll be sure to have boxed wine in our shopping list for sure. Okay, thank you very much for coming in, and it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much, guys.
Oh, every time I've done an outro, I've messed it up. Thank you, listeners, for reminding me. Where can people find more about Layla?
So,
very important. The whole point.
Very important. So, head to our website, which is drinklaylo, LAYLO.com. And also do drop us a follow on Instagram, also at drinklaylo, for all the behind the scenes stories, all these exciting developments you'll be first to know.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Cheers.
WTF is Retail, presented by Excellent Zephyr.